how ironical it is that in this intellectual sense, you were more free in China than you are here in Canada.
In China, we have much more rules than Canadian, but It is not rule of law, it is a dictatorship.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Grey Matter. Well, most Canadians are unaware that professions like law, medicine, and psychology are actually supervised by self-governing societies. They were created by statutory law to be self-governing so that they would be independent of government control or ideological influence. But recently, physicians who have appeared in this program, like Dr. Eric Payne and Daniel Nagase, were suspended by their medical college for challenging COVID-19 vaccine heterodoxy. Dr. Jordan Peterson is engaged in a very highly publicized fight with the Psychological College in Ontario, who are mandating him to take media sensitivity training. Seems to me with his success on the social media, he should probably be teaching that course. But most recently, an Alberta chiropractor's legal challenge against mask mandates opposed by his professional college were dismissed by a human rights tribunal despite overwhelming evidence presented by world-renowned medical experts showing that masks actually do more harm than good. Well, today we'll be speaking to a couple of courageous Alberta lawyers who spearheaded a petition against mandatory Indigenous sensitivity training by their law society, training which really has no relevance to the competency of lawyers practicing in the province. We'll discover why they did it, what happened to the petition, and most importantly, what they intend to do about it. They are Roger Song and Glenn Blackett. Welcome to Grey Matter, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perhaps we could start as we usually do, with our framing aphorisms. Again, some of these are chosen in the honor of our guests. The first one is from someone I mentioned in the opening. This is Dr. Jordan Peterson, who wrote, "A world without freedom of speech is a world of slavery and tyranny." From C.S. Lewis, a quotation that I've mentioned on this program before, "Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive." And finally, from St. Thomas More, who is you might know as the patron Catholic saint of lawyers, lost his head for challenging the King of England, who wrote, "One of the greatest problems of our time," it's still our time, "is that many are schooled, but few are educated." So on the show today, we have Glenn Blackett. Glenn is a civil rights lawyer working in Calgary with the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. We also have Roger Song, who has an extensive international legal experience and language skills. Roger helps Canadian companies and entrepreneurs to develop business relationship and opportunities and in negotiation and to close commercial transactions with Chinese partners and companies and make investment in province of Alberta, mainland China, and Asia market. And he is also a lawyer, as we said, in the province of Alberta. So perhaps we could start with Roger. Roger, I understand that you were very intimately involved in the launching of a petition that was signed by a number of Alberta lawyers, including myself, against a mandatory course on Indigenous history. Would you perhaps start out by telling us a little bit about the petition, how it got started, and why you did it?
Okay, well, thank you, Gray. Okay, so we sent out a letter to the profession July 13, 2022. Basically, we asked our peers to endorse our petition to repeal Rule 67.4 of the Rules of Alberta Law Society. And that rule basically says debentures have the power to impose whatever specific education they think are in the interest of the public to all the professions of Alberta under the penalty of automatic suspension. In other words, they have the power to impose whatever education they believe that we should take. And if we disobey, they have the power to automatically suspend our legal license to practice. So personally, in order to get that license in Canada, I endured 7 years law schools in Beijing, in China. I got my LLM degree from NYU and have my license to practice in New York. And then I came back. When I came to Canada, I went back to law school at the University of Calgary, do my 3 years JD, and do my 1 year articling. Finally, I got my license to practice law in Canada at age of 50. So in other words, under this rule, the law society just can't suspend my license to practice law in Canada just because I don't want to participate their doctrination. I think, to be clear, our petition is not about the First Nation issue. In our letter, July 13 to the profession, Mr. Benjamin Furland and I co-authored this letter. We make it very specifically saying, to be clear, we do not oppose Rule 67.4 based on a belief that understanding Indigenous culture is unimportant. Rather, we oppose it because we do not believe the benchers have or should have the power to mandate cultural, political, and ideological education of any kind on Alberta lawyers as a condition of practice. We believe the profession and our clients are best served by an approach to CBD, recognizing that individual lawyers and firms, not the benchers, are best situated to understand and address their CBD requirements and professional needs. So that's the basic background of the. So we start from there, June 17, 13, we send our letter, and gradually we receive the signature support of lawyers. And eventually, it still took me like 7 months or maybe 5 months to get the required 50 signatures. Right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm a new immigrant, I have no connection, I'm sole practitioners, right? Not well connected. So that's the background.
So Glenn, you're obviously a lawyer who's involved specifically in human rights, civil liberties, with the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. This is obviously something that's of concern to you and also to the Justice Center. Do you want to explain a little bit why, what the essence of this is? Because I know that in the mass media, this has been misplayed as some sort of racism or bigotry or insensitivity to Indigenous peoples, but it really has nothing to do with that, does it?
Well, it depends on your definition of racism, I suppose. If by racism you mean opposing any particular viewpoint, then I guess it is a kind of a racism.
That was Trotsky's original definition, I think.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Perfect. We're right back to where we started.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, and I've said this a million times, every petitioner signed the petition for its own reason. And I signed petition for my own reasons. I wouldn't even say they're the Justice Center's reasons. I didn't sign it as a member of the Justice Center, although that's what I do as a living. But, you know, my opposition was both, I'd say, the mode and content of that training. And by mode, I mean, you know, the authoritarian style with which it was handed down by our law society. You know, I don't think that if you look at the Legal Professions Act, it's at all clear that they have the power to impose any CPD or be involved, frankly, in CPD in any way. They had an old rule, 67.1, 2, and 3, which said, you know, there's some criteria that they imposed saying, you know, it's got to relate to your practice or ethics or law or something, but you have to be doing CPD and you have to report to us what CPD you're doing. And even that rule, I mean, I didn't have a problem with it because it was easy to comply with and it still left me in charge of deciding what I need to do to ensure that I am competent in my practice, given my particular, you know, practice and clientele. Even though I didn't have a problem with the rule, I still didn't think they had the power to impose it, but that's fine. So I complied with that rule along with every other lawyer, I think, or most other lawyers. I don't think it was well enforced, and I don't know that anyone read my plan to see if they liked it or something like that. But rule 67.4 was, you know, the next level of intrusion into the lawyer's independence. And, you know, instead of saying, well, we have the power to ensure that you're doing CPD, they took the power to impose particular CPD. So, you know, I don't care what practice area you're in. I don't care what your clientele look like. I don't care what your history is. I don't care what you know, what doctorate you might have in history. You're going to do this particular kind of training because, according to the Law Society, it's going to make me more competent to practice as a lawyer, which, I mean, for the most part, is kind of absurd because I don't deal in indigenous law very often. So the mode of it, you know, imposing that training. And I should mention too that when the Law Society imposed that additional form of CPD where they could tell lawyers exactly what to do under Rule 67.4, they excused themselves from all of those requirements under the rules that training relate to things like substantive law or professional ethics or any of that kind of stuff. And I think that was probably wise that they do so because the path didn't seem to align with that concept of professional development at all. Mm-hmm. So that was part of my problem. And then I think I stand apart from many of the petitioners in that I opposed the content of the path as well. I thought it was a bad history. It was a slanted history. It was a bad and slanted history for the purpose of driving home a propagandistic point. And it was bad politics. You know, it basically suggests a number of policies, let's say, that fine, you can propose those policies, but those policies should be something that are, first of all, presented in the public forum, in the democratic forum where you're presenting it to elected legislators. I think that, you know, we have this theory that we now base our policy on evidence. Therefore, I think it should have been an evidence-based policy argument, which would require looking at evidence on both sides of the issues that they've presented and, you know, should have been presented along with advocates of opposing positions. And I would take as the figurehead of that movement, maybe a Francis Whittleson or a Tom Flanagan, to talk really about, you know, I think their proposal would be that, you know, economic integration is how you enhance the economic outcomes of a society, not economic isolation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I had substantive objections to the content of the path that I don't think were shared by many. And I don't think they were shared by many because they wouldn't if they knew more about it. But the more you unpeel that onion, the more it makes you want to cry for the validity of it.
Roger, I'd like to come back to you because you mentioned you shared that you come from China. This must have been especially troubling for you, given that you left a society in which let's face it, civil liberties and that sort of thing are suppressed, a society in which censorship is normalized, and in which indoctrination is really part of the culture. I take it you probably came to the West, the United States, and Canada to escape all this. So this must be especially troubling for you to sort of have this mandatory investigation and almost like a post-traumatic stress situation for you. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, thanks, Leighton, you raised that. Yes, exactly. So when I see the notice from the Law Society saying this is the cultural competence requirement, so they use specifically the word cultural competence, that immediately reminds me of another phrase called cultural revolution or political competence in China. So when I was in China, I received 17 years education. I was working as a professor at the university, Beijing University Law School. I have to take one specific subject of course, and that course is called Competence of Ideology. Basically, that course is indoctrination of Marxist communism ideas and regime and worldview. I have to take that course from grade one up to my graduate school. If I fail that subject, I cannot be advanced to a higher level of education. I cannot be admitted into the school that I want to go, right? So that is the, I really hate that type of indoctrination course, because I have to memorize everything. I have to uncritically accept everything they told me and put it on paper, say, this is the answer, right? But I have no choice. I have no choice. Exactly as you said, I came to Canada because, you know, the culture of Canada is attracting to me. Nobody in China compel me to take a mandatory education on the culture of Canada so that I can make the decision not to immigrate to Africa, not immigrate to South America, but to Canada, because Canada's culture is attractive to me based on my knowledge, based on my interaction with Canadian scholars visiting the campus, interacting with the Canadian students visiting the campus in Beijing University, based on my understanding through social media. Nobody imposed me a mandatory education. So I think it's a big irony that, you know, this subject is to make me to be culturally competent on indigenous people. But I have the I can show you, wave that piece of certificate of achievement of completing the path to you. Mm-hmm. But still, I'm now blamed by so many misinformed, misguided people as a racist. Mm-hmm. This subject has nothing to do at all with First Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Even yesterday, well, from the media, I saw a chief say blaming 800 Alberta lawyers for being against First Nation. I think in mm-hmm. China, one of the techniques of the authority is to engage the struggle among different classes of people. Right? Mm-hmm. That's their game of controlling people. That's their game of keeping in power, right? Mm-hmm. So when I saw this, I mean, it's kind of big division of pro First Nation or pro Indigenous people or someone like me who are against. That's the old game. Now, I'm too familiar in China. I think they're mm-hmm. trying to do this to me. It just reminds me of all this kind of ugly political game and denial of truth, right? So mm-hmm. truth can only be accepted and denied, but you cannot change it. The truth mm-hmm. is that the lawyers stand up against the indoctrination of the law society. That's the truth. We are not mm-hmm. against First Nation people. We are not against the indigenous people. I think I would expect the law society, in order to promote the awareness of First Nation people or indigenous people, they can do a couple of things. They can give guidance on the level of training required, right? Mm-hmm. If you're advising an indigenous client on the subject of divorce, you have to understand what he or she is coming from, what mm-hmm. for background, right? How he got married, that type of stuff, very specific. Right, you mm-hmm. cannot just sit in a dark room in front of a computer for 5 hours and suddenly you're expert of Canadian, you know, indigenous mm-hmm. people's culture. That's a delusion, right? Mm-hmm. Secondly, the law society can provide options on training required. They provide none. They just compel me to sit in front of a computer to do 5 hours modules, which has nothing to do with my practice, has nothing to do with any service I have to provide to any particular indigenous client. The law society can also encourage people to talk to the indigenous people directly, right? To understand their culture, history, suffering, and challenges. I think later I understood that you are a First Nation people. Right, you are a senior counsel of the profession. Why don't law society ask you to give us a seminar, to give us a dialogue, right? To share the family, the history mm-hmm. of your family, the experience of your family, mm-hmm. Whether it's good or bad with the residential school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be wonderful. We have all kinds of like First Nation lawyers in our society. Right. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to engage a firm which is a profit, it's not non-profit, it's a profit federal organization based in Ottawa?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's,
to study their program. First, yeah.
No, you make some excellent points, Roger. And, you know, I think the short answer is that I don't see the legal profession or any aspect of it or the plight of Indigenous peoples through the lens of racism. That's number one. But how ironical it is that in this intellectual sense, you were more free in China than you are here in Canada. Glenn, I want to turn back to you for a moment. And I know and most people realize that this vote actually went against those who brought the petition. And that was sort of expected. But was it unexpected, the level of backlash and name calling and derision and sort of doxing and cancel culture that resulted on behalf of not only journalists and people like that, but also other lawyers? Was that a shock to you that there was such a vehement outcry against the people who brought this petition?
No, that's how it's done. You know, that's I expected there to be virtually no substantive, meaningful dialogue. Mm-hmm. Because that's just the way that wokeness is propagated. It's propagated through vilification and rhetoric and trickery, really. You know, I mean, before the interview, you circulated this article from Daniel Song, unrelated, a BC lawyer that provided his comments in the CBC. And the thing is just rife, full of mischaracterizations of, you know, both what people think, what people have said, whether or not, I mean, the big one being the thing that I started with, which is that every petitioner signed the petition for their own reason. He seems to know much better than I do that, in fact, every single petitioner who signed it because they're anti-Indigenous somehow, mm-hmm. which is, you know, anyway, so I've come to expect it. You know, if there was a substantive, meaningful argument in support of these policies, then they would be advanced. But because mm-hmm. there isn't, because I'd say the psychology of the person who advances these policies is anathema to reason, mm-hmm. you know, which is wokeness properly defined is actually, you know, attacks reason, rationality, objective truth, scientific method, rule of law, equality before the law, all those kinds of concepts that you would think a lawyer would be engaging and would be arguing, you know, from that position in order to demonstrate the both legality of Rule 67.4 and also the propriety of the contents of the path itself. But wokeness believes that those are just constructs of an unfair, unjust power hierarchy. So, mm-hmm. you know, even reason itself, which sounds crazy. You would think, no, surely people that, you know, that have these opinions couldn't oppose reason. Why would they open their mouth and talk about things if they don't believe in reason? Mm-hmm. Well, they don't open their mouths and talk about it using mm-hmm. reason. They open up their mouths and talk about it using power. What right. kind of power? Fear, vilification, isolation, that kind of stuff. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, I found it perfectly predictable.
This is very concerning because, of course, the law is a self-governing profession, and it needs to be. It needs to be immune and apart from government influence. But as Roger noted, this consulting firm that designed the path is an Ottawa firm. And I took the path course. I've also read all 3,400 pages of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report. And I can tell you that that the PATH course does not accurately represent what is stated in that report, at least not fully, not its full import. But the deeper concern that we have here is that it begins to look, Roger, as though the federal government's ideas about things like diversity, inclusion, equity, and critical race theory and things of that nature are actually finding their way into the governing societies, these professional societies, which are designed to be independent of government influence. Is that a concern for you, Roger? Is that part of why you created this?
Exactly. Exactly. this type of a requirement of cultural competence, I think it is a very dangerous requirement, because when I was called into the bar, I gave a full license to practice without a subject subcondition that, okay, subsequently, if you are not culturally incompetent, the law society can take away your license with no further notice, with no hearing. So that reminds me, my experience in China, you have to be politically competent, meaning you have to support the leadership of CCP. You have to support everything that's said by CCP. If you disagree, you are politically incompetent. Therefore, you have no career. You have no future in China. That's why I fled from China, came to Canada, but I was worried that, you know, one law society imposed this cultural competence. What is the definition of corporate cultural competence? In which eyes, you know, that I'm culturally competent or not, right? To my Chinese client, I'm culturally competent, right? But if I have some views on First Nation issue, if I disagree the way of educating First Nation culture, then suddenly I will be culturally incompetent. I will be blamed as a racist. And then I also saw the media, some Alberta lawyers suggesting that all these 50 lawyers should be disbarred, right? Mm-hmm. That type of thinking, that type of training is very dangerous.
Right? That's
ironically, I think we should be, you know, professionally competent, not culturally competent, not politically competent. I think that's the basic difference.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. And Glenn, just to come back to you, I know that the Law Society and even some lawyers were suggesting that this is just a one-off. This is a one-time thing, that the Law Society doesn't plan any further forays into mandatory intellectual education, that is, or political education, I should say. But you've done some research to show that, in fact, that's not true, is it? That there is a concern this is the beginning of a slippery slope.
Yeah, I mean, I can't get into the heads of the benchers, and I haven't looked at their minutes, so I don't know exactly what they've got planned. But there's a lot of data points which would suggest otherwise, starting with, again, the political ideology that we're dealing with, which is, you know, wokeness. And wokeness is not a point in time thing you learn about and then we're done. It's a journey. You look through the path. As you go through the path, they repeat over and over and over that this is the beginning of a journey, beginning of a journey, beginning of a journey. And you look at the Law Society's website and they talk about that. And consistent with that, in the annual general meeting of the Law Society on December 1st, 2022, in what I thought was kind of an Orwellian statement, the president, Ken Warren, first, and I'll paraphrase this as best I can, that he wanted to commend the lawyers on their participation in the path, which, of course, was mandatory. And if you didn't do it, 28 lawyers found out, you get suspended. So I don't know what there is to commend there. But first, he commended us, and then he said, and we want to, I believe, confirm our commitment to providing further opportunities in the future. So there's that. That seems to be an express statement that there's more coming down the pipe. Then if you look at their website, first of all, I don't know when it was inserted, but I think it was no later than 2019. They inserted as one of their five statutory mandates, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is just wokeness defined. Mm-hmm. And diversity, equity, and inclusion is, again, it's a path. It's a journey from diversity to equity. And you don't, you know, you're once you get on that path and sign up for that path, you become a sworn activist, a person whose moral obligation it is to pursue that, let's borrow a word from China, cultural revolution, the eternal revolution, right? We have to pursue that revolution until we reach this utopian paradise that's at the end of it all. And that utopian paradise is called equity. Mm-hmm. And if you want to understand what equity is, when do we find ourselves at equity? Well, first of all, until we find ourselves, the Law Society, as long as they're on board with this ideology, they can't stop being activists, because that would be a betrayal of those principles. But what is equity? You look at the Law Society's own website, they talk about systemic discrimination. They have a definition of systemic discrimination, and everyone should probably look it up themselves, but what I get from it is any system that results in any kind of difference between people based on any identity characteristic. So, you know, one example would be any system that results in some kind of a difference between people based on race. So then you say, okay, well, if that's what we mean by systemic discrimination, you know, what does it mean to not have systemic discrimination? It means where we have no such system.
One of the things that is admirable about lawyers, and especially ones who have a cause to fight for, is they don't give up. And that applies equally to the two of you. So this petition was unsuccessful, but that's not the end of the matter. I understand that you're in the process of developing, let's say, a new project. And it has a vision quest. I received notice of this morning. Roger, do you want to talk about this a little bit? What is the vision quest all about? But perhaps I'll get both of you to comment on it, because I know Glenn has worked on it as well.
I was blamed by a lot of people being a racist because I said to CBC News that I don't believe that Canada is a society of systemic discrimination. But I made that statement in a context. When I made that statement, I say to the reporter of CBC, saying, look, you know, I'm an immigrant from China, right? But I was able to go to law school at 46, you know, get my JD degree at 49, got my license 50, doing my articling, working as socialist lawyer with a top level Canadian firm. So to me, I appreciate Canada. I feel like I was accepted, I was helped, I was welcomed, I was given the opportunity as long as I work hard. I think that's the system that I'm looking for, right? Mm-hmm. In China, you're not politically or culturally competent, you're done, no matter how competent in your profession, right? Mm-hmm. But when I came to Canada, I made a statement that I don't believe that Canada is a society of systemic discrimination based on my personal experience. When I talk to CBC News, we're not talking about anything about discrimination on the First Nation Indigenous people, right? Mm-hmm. But the CBC News just cut my statement. And after they released the report, I have the track record of the email to the reporter, try to, you know, fix this misunderstanding, but they refuse, right? So that's why Daniel Song, by the way, he has nothing to do with me, and I have nothing to do with him. We just only share a common family name called Song, but we are not relatives to each other. But by the end, we are relatives because we are all descendants of Eden, right? We are all created in the image of God. So everyone, including the First Nation people, we are all created in the image of God. We are brothers and sisters. If you look at the Bible, from the beginning, we are one big family, right? So I think the last comment I just want to leave here.
You make a great point, Roger, and it's worth stating. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the actual report, in all of its glory, does not come to the conclusion that Canada is a systemically racist country. It does not come to the conclusion that what happened at Indian residential schools amounted to genocide. It does not say that. There is a summary. The federal government has produced a summary which says things of that nature and imports this concept of critical race theory, which is really an American concept that's been developed by race baiters like Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi into Canadian discourse, where it does not belong. It's completely incongruous. The plight of Black people in the United States is completely different from that of Indigenous peoples in Canada. But you make an excellent point, but I just wanted to note that the report itself does not find that Canada is a systemically racist country. In fact, there's very little evidence of that. And you can look no further than to the fact that I believe I saw a recent report that nearly 5 million people from around the world are trying to get into this systemically racist country. Anyway, Roger, I cut you off. Go ahead and talk about the vision quest. I just wanted to follow up what you said.
Yes, I think after this, I think, you know, by reflection, you know, obviously we were defeated by the vote, right? Overwhelmingly, that's fine. We waste, it's big loss. But looking back, I think we have a lot of achievements. I think, first of all, I think by the end of the day, we're, there are not just only 50 lawyers who are against this, right? There are more than 800. And I have friends call me, they were locked out, that they were not be able to get in, but they were going to vote in support of the motion. So I suppose that if you include those people who are locked out, but were intended to vote in favor of the motion, it's way more than 800 people, right? So that's very big encouragement. The second thing is that through the process, I have the opportunity to get connected with a lot of wonderful people and great, great lawyers in the province. I think that is a true privilege to me, right? If other than for this process, I have no chance to know Mr. Blackhead, I have no chance to know Mr. Gray, all the other great lawyers. And also I receive a lot of emails, phone calls, from Saskatchewan, from Ontario, a lot of them from the province, you know, encouraging me, right? Say, hey, Roger, I think we're supporting you. I think you're raising an issue of principle, you know. I think that gives me hope. I think, you know, most Canadian people have common sense. Most Canadian people, you know, they are independent, well, people. They don't want to be subject to this type of indoctrination. I think people are people. It, not just Chinese people don't like indoctrination. In the beginning, I thought, well, maybe just Chinese people don't like it. I mean, people don't like it either, right? So I think let's talk about the vision. I think the vision is that I think it's a good start for us. It's also a good journey for us, right? To promote awareness of the woke culture. To promote awareness of the mistake made in China, to avoid those kind of indoctrination, to avoid those kind of mandatory education that I experienced in China. I was trying, you know, working for half of my life to flee from that culture. Don't let that happen to our next generation, especially of Canadian people, right? So when I came to Canada, when I swear to become a citizen, the first line I see under the Constitution of Canada is that Canada is built on the foundation of the supremacy of God and the rule of law.
That's the distinctive feature.
That is the distinctive feature of our nation. Don't forget it, right? No. If you don't have the supremacy of God, if you don't have the truth, you don't have rule of law. In China, you have we have much more rules than Canadian, fine together, but it is not rule of law. It is a dictatorship.
Right.
I want the Canadian people to wake up, not by this kind of indoctrination.
So, Glenn, you've come up with sort of a plan, working plan now. This vision quest. You're trying to find a name for this new, I guess, collaborative effort of lawyers. To try and raise awareness and get organized and really take on this woke ideology. And did you want to talk about that a little bit, what the plan is, and is there a name for it yet? And what does the future hold for that? Or I know we're really in the early stages, but I think this is something that is very exciting and encouraging, especially for members of the legal profession, perhaps for society at large.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Well, part of the object of my work right now is to try to see where we're aligned, where the people in the petition are aligned. Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people signed that petition for different reasons. A lot of people didn't have any problems with I don't think they even detected the ideology inside the path or the ideology that manifests itself in Rule 67.4 or have any problem with the ideology that's otherwise saturated in the Law Society's statutory objectives and stuff. But so I come at it from one particular angle, and my angle would be that of a classic liberal, I would say, also an atheist. I recognize that we're a culture that historically has been informed and largely is informed by a Christian moral ethic. And I have no problem with the Christian moral ethic. I just don't happen to believe in you know, that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and that there's such a thing as God. But, you know, still turn the other cheek.
We'll win you over. Roger and I will win you over.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we'll see. You know, turn the other cheek. Just the common humanity of people. Love your neighbor like you love yourself or more, maybe. Those are all, I think, beautiful, moral, and important values for to hold a country together in a cohesive, you know, productive way. And I think that that morality is a big part of the reason that the West was so socioeconomically dynamic and successful, whether, you know, whatever your definition is of successful. But so anyway, I come at it from a slightly different perspective, but I would say I'm what I think most Canadians believe that the law and the Constitution is, which is a classic liberal. You know, I believe in limited government, which doesn't mean a small government. I'm not necessarily a libertarian, but it means that there has to be limits on government, because the bigger government becomes and the more it invades every aspect of your life, the less freedom you have. Just by definition, that's
right.
There's no way past that. So I believe in that. I believe in the rule of law. I believe in equality before the law. I believe in objective reality. I wouldn't say I believe in truth. Roger likes the word truth, and I definitely understand the importance of truth and the evil of a public lie and the destructiveness of a public lie.
Right.
But I would say the more nuanced kind of scientific Western approach is not so much truth as it is a journey away from error or perhaps towards truth, but it's the process of finding truth, which is free speech, diversity of opinion, no censorship, you know, empirical observation, reason, the application of reason to empirical observation, and then, you know, positing falsifiable hypotheses that you attempt to disprove. And if you can't, you provide your method, your data, and everything to other scientists to try to challenge and discredit that. That whole process towards truth is something that also underpins the successes of Western nations historically. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, and I think, I mean, that was definitely the mindset that both, you know, created Canada, that was the reason that Canada succeeded along with other Western states, and the same theory to some extent, which informed the Charter. Although I would argue that the Charter was the beginning of, well, not the beginning, but was a step towards judicial legislation. Let's put it that way.
And secularization of Canadian society, certainly. If you take, for example, you know, the first big Charter case being Big M Drug Mart and what that did to the Lord's Day Act, that was really the beginning of not only what you talked about, creating an environment in which the Supreme Court of Canada could really determine and set the values for a nation, but also it really set the tone for the secularization of Canada. And we can disagree on this, and Roger and I would agree to our detriment. In fact, I'll just mention Michael Wagner, wonderful Alberta author, has written a brilliant book called Moving Past God that talks about this concept. Anyway, Glenn, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just want to sort of add in and add to your point.
Yeah, I mean, they congratulate themselves on being the most progressive court in the world, which, you know, again, depends what you mean by progress, but progressive these days means woke. And yeah, so
it's a euphemism. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, a progress towards what? You know, again, I would say it's a progress towards a dark vision for humanity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's anyway, so to get back to this organization, that would be my belief is that, you know, if we look at the path, for example, the path about 50 or 60 times attacks the entire legal system as colonial, as genocidal, as inherently racist, as, you know, just terrible, terrible, terrible. Okay. Well, if you accept that to be the case, then what's the prescription? Well, it's to undo all of that. It's decolonization. It's anti-racism. It's whatever term you want to use to describe dismantling that Western legal system.
I call it nihilism.
Yeah. I mean, close to nihilism, because I think wokeness is so superficial. There's sure. So little substantive content there that It's just a, it's just a dream. Mm-hmm. But the point is that, you know, we have a law society here that's attacking the legal system as just inherently corrupt. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if that's the case, then we have a law society here that's saying that lawyers should be trained up in this concept that the legal system has to be dismantled. You know how thoroughly, exactly what, I don't know, but you know, it seems to be a limitless attack on the legal system. So we've got somebody embedded in the legal system with a very important powers and very influential. The law society, that is, that, and all of it, the lawyers that rally around that aspect of its mandate, who are now, you know, activist supporters of the concept that we ought to dismantle all of the things that up until last week we understood to be part of our, you know, our liberal democracy. Mm-hmm. And so I think lawyers need to, you know, I think the people in the that signed the petition because they thought 67.4 was just some overreach and, you know, we should be sort of limited in our approach in terms of what we attack, I think they're missing the boat. You know, it's 67.4 was a tentacle of wokeness, and there's going to be a bunch more tentacles. We need to attack wokeness because it's something that's attacking our legal system, and our legal system, I think, is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's perfect. Yeah. I'm not saying it's perfect.
As is our profession. I applaud you gentlemen for doing this. I sort of had an early taste of this, a bitter one, a few years ago in 2020 when I was summarily dismissed from the Law Society, from a Law Society committee where I served as an adjudicator in Law Society disciplinary hearings. And I was summarily dismissed without even being given an opportunity to speak on my behalf by the Law Society. Then President Kent Teske, who I understand spoke in favor or against the petition, the former president summarily dismissed me based upon a CBC report, which painted me as a racist because I spoke out against the truth or the lack of truth in diversity, inclusion, equity. And I spoke out against things like Black Lives Matter, which turned out to mean, you know, big luxury mansions. But in any case, gentlemen, this has been a wonderful discussion. I thank you for this time. We're at the part of the show where we sort of wrap up with something called the reading list. And so if each of you have a book or two that you'd like to recommend or an article or a website, I'm going to come to you and ask you to provide those. There's a couple of books that I'd like to recommend to the people taking this in. One is one that I would recommend to really anyone who's interested in the truth about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This is a book that's published by the Frontier Center for Public Policy called From Truth Comes Reconciliation. People who follow this program know that we had the author, Dr. Rodney Clifton, who's a brilliant scholar, Canadian scholar on this program. This book, I actually had the pleasure of writing the foreword to it. It's going into its second edition now. I just wrote a revised foreword to it, but this book, the publisher's description is as follows. While the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, heard many experiences of unspeakable abuse, we have been heartened by testimonies which affirm the dedication and compassion of committed educators who sought to nurture the children in their care. These experiences must also be heard. That's from Senator Murray Sinclair, chair of the commission. So this book tells the full story, and it is replete. It is a very, very careful history, copiously documented, and it tells the truth about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And it's not the version that's being told by our federal governments or by universities in this country or in the Law Society course called The Path. The second book is one that is written by a lady named Frances Whittison, who Glenn referred to earlier. She's been very much in the news. She's written several books on this topic, and she was recently banned from speaking at the University of Lethbridge. One of her books is called Separate But Unequal, How Parallelist Ideology Conceals Indigenous Dependency. And here she uses the final report of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples as an example. This historical and material analysis shows how the single-minded pursuit of parallelism will not result in a more balanced relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. One example of parallelism being, of course, reconciliation, that concept, On the contrary, it merely restores our archaic economic, political, and ideological forms that will continue to isolate the indigenous population. So that essentially she argues, and she argues persuasively, I think, that this whole idea of reconciliation assumes that we're apart, rather than presuming that we are together in this country and sharing it together, that we're all Canadians. And that actually when we start talking about reconciliation, we start from a point of division. And we don't have to start there. We can start at a point where we're already reconciled and we're committed towards working together to share the country in a way that's meaningful and peaceful and productive. The last book I have is one called Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity. This is a great book from authors Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay. The reason why I point this book out is because it's actually written by university professors who don't like wokeism. And they explain why in the book. They also explain what it means, how this ideas like critical theory, diversity, inclusion, equity, how they got started. They talk about the experience in China that Roger has talked about. And so it's a great book that will provide a backdrop to the actual ideas that fuel this woke ideology. And how dangerous it is and how harmful it is to everyone in society. And it's really something that in Canada we need to reject, as Roger has pointed out. So Roger, do you have a suggestion or two about resources people could turn to, a book or something of that nature that will enhance understanding of this topic?
If from my bottom of my heart, if you truly want me to recommend a book, I would recommend the Holy Bible.
Well, that one has been recommended on this program many times before, and it's great because it actually has 66 books, at least the one I read. There are other
exactly.
versions.
Exactly, it's a library. Right. And also, I think on the subject of the reconciliation, I think the Holy Spirit tells me that the true reconciliation is about canceling debts of each other, forgiving. Right. Each other for the transgressions against each other. It is about God forgiving us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Mm-hmm. That's the true reconciliation. That's the true reconciliation is not to compel a lawyer to memorize all these sufferings to carry this hate of the colonialism, of the British legal tradition, of the Canadian legal system moving forward. That is not true reconciliation. That is not what I take the oath when I was called into the bar in the great province of Alberta.
Mm-hmm. Well, Roger just quoted the Lord's Prayer, which some of us when we were kids actually recited in school each morning. Some of us think we were a better country back then. Anyway, Glenn, turning to you, do you have a suggestion or two about resources people can access, books they can read that will enhance their understanding of what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Lindsay and Pluckrose book is an excellent pick on your behalf. There's also, I didn't realize that James Lindsay does a podcast called New Discourses. And
yes.
I've been.
Yes, it's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. I just started listening to it. And episode 108 is Gnosticism in the Modern West, mm-hmm. which is his thesis that wokeism is basically a Gnostic cult.
Yeah.
Which is, it's fascinating. Anyway, that would be an interesting listen. My two main go-tos are Karl Popper's An Open Society and Its Enemies.
Yes. That was not on our list. Thanks for that.
Yeah, and it's a beast, but and I have to read it again.
It's beefy.
But it's interesting because, I mean, for many reasons. But he, first of all, you know, he's writing this in about, I think it was the late 40s when he was writing it. It's not an attack on wokeism as we currently understand it, but I think what he shows in that book is that mindset, that sort of approach towards politics is something that's been with us since forever. Mm-hmm. And he traces it back at least to Plato and Plato's Republic and the whole concept of the benevolent dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And then traces it through Hegel and other thinkers. Anyway, it's a fascinating book. The other one that I would recommend is Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism.
That one is on our reading list, but a wonderful, incredibly eye-opening book. We also had recently a book that was discussed in this program when we had Dr. Robert Malone on. There's a new book by Matthias Desmond called The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And it's a wonderful companion. If people are going to read the Arendt book, the Desmond book is a wonderful companion to that book because it sort of builds on the structure of what Hannah Arendt wrote about in that book. Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion. Thanks for that, Glenn. I mean, I know people say that it's an overstatement and hyperbole that we're on a slippery slope towards totalitarianism, but anybody who's read Hannah Arendt's books and who has witnessed what has happened in Canada over the past, I would say within the last 10 to 15 years, we're moving somewhere and we're moving away from a freedom-loving society that has as its structure the supremacy of God and the rule of law. We're moving away from a society that cherishes civil liberties and individual choice. And I think this, just to sum it up, this is a great example of what we've been talking about today. I've been a lawyer in this province for a long time. I'm privileged to be. I'm very proud of that. The lawyers I've known are some of the very best, most principled, most intelligent people that I've known in my lifetime. And I happen to believe that if the Law Society had simply made the information available to lawyers, lawyers are educated people. We are nerds. We are geeks. We are the people who were high school valedictorians and honor students. And we didn't get to be lawyers by accident because we're not curious because we don't like to read things. If they had made this information available, I would say the vast majority, nearly all the lawyers in this province would have read it and they would have formed their own opinions about it. And they would have formed better opinions about it, more useful opinions about it than the ones that they have formed by through mandatory education. That's my two cents, but this happens to be my show. So there it is. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much. I'm so grateful for having you on the program. I also want to express special appreciation as a senior member of the Law Society of Alberta for the courage that you showed in adopting a principled approach and circulating this petition and conducting yourselves ethically and admirably, suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And also for taking the bull by the horns and forging a new path forward. I'm very excited about this project that you are putting together, and I hope to be a contributor to it and to help to be part of it. So once again, thank you so much to both of you for being part of Grey Matter today. It's been my pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Grey.